Today we're going to be thinking about practical love and table fellowship. Practical love and table fellowship, and that's within our overall theme of love and the people of God. First time I read this passage, I'm going to read it out of the Message. So you might be better to listen, and then later we'll go to the Good News version. And the passage I'm actually going to read is Matthew chapter 5, and I'm going to begin at verse 21. And it might be labelled something like, actually I'm not, I'm going to begin at verse 13. Might be labelled something like salt and light in your version. And I'm going to read down to the end of verse 26. So in the Message, this is what's written, and it's Jesus speaking. He's speaking to his disciples. Let me tell you why you are here. You're here to be salt seasoning that brings out the God flavors on this earth. If you lose your saltiness, you will be, how will people taste godliness? You've lost your usefulness and will end up in the garbage. Here's another way to put it. You're here to be light, bringing out the God colors in the world. God is not a secret to be kept. We're going public with this, as public as a city on a hill. If I make you light bearers, you don't think I'm going to hide you under a bucket, do you? I'm putting you on a light stand. Now that I've put you there, on a hilltop, on a light stand, shine, as the song says. Keep open house. Be generous with your lives by opening up to others. You'll prompt people to open up with God, this generous Father in heaven. Don't suppose for a minute that I have come to demolish the scriptures, either God's law or the prophets. I'm not here to demolish, but to complete. I am going to put it all together, pull it all together in a vast panorama. God's law is more real and lasting than the stars in the sky and the ground at your feet. Long after stars burn out and earth wears out, God's law will be alive and working. Trivialize even the smallest item in God's law, and you will only have trivialized yourself. But take it seriously. Show the way for others, and you will find honor in the kingdom. Unless you do far better than the Pharisees in the matters of right living, you won't know the first thing about entering the kingdom. You're familiar with the command to the ancients, do not murder. I'm telling you that anyone who is so much as angry with a brother or sister is guilty of murder. Carelessly call a brother idiot, and you just might find yourself hauled into court. Thoughtlessly yell stupid at a sister, and you are on the brink of hellfire. The simple moral fact is that words kill. This is how I want you to conduct yourself in these matters. If you enter your place of worship and about to make an offering, you suddenly remember a grudge a friend has against you, abandon your offering, leave immediately, go to this friend and make things right. Then and only then, come back and work things out with God. Jesus, in his ministry, was beginning to gain crowds of popularity, it says in verse 1 of chapter 5. But as the crowds start coming towards him, he singles out the committed, his disciples, for deeper teaching. And just to check that they really are disciples who will follow him wherever he goes, he makes them climb up a hill, a small mountain, which is really a picture, isn't it, of are you prepared to follow me, even if it means going uphill, even if it gets difficult, even if it requires your energy, even if it makes you sweat, even if it makes you hungry, are you prepared to follow me wherever I take you? He calls them apart and takes them to talk to them about righteousness, about living in a way that pleases God, living in ways that are pleasing to God's eyes. And we know from verse 20 in chapter 5 that Jesus specifically developed his teaching on what being truly righteous, living right before God, meant. And he said to his disciples, the way you live has got to surpass the standards, the moral patterns of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Well, that's an amazing statement, because they were considered very, very religious. They took great attention to religious detail, as we know. But he says, your righteousness, the way you live, has got to surpass their understanding of righteousness. So straight away, he's actually being critical of what they, the religious, regarded as pleasing to God. And he says, if the way you live doesn't surpass this sort of living, you will not enter the kingdom of God. By that he meant you'll not truly be in covenant with God. You won't really experience the blessings of God. Your lives need to surpass these people. So he starts to make them think, well, what is righteous living? If the Pharisees haven't got it right, if the scribes haven't got it right, what is pleasing to God? What is the right way to live? Now, if that's not a moral question, I don't know what is a moral question. What is the right way to live that God considers the right way? You know, the difficulty was there were so many different teachers within Judaism that there was tremendous confusion. And some people said, well, I like what that rabbi teaches, so I'll go and follow him. Those scribes are okay, so I'll follow them. And there were all sorts of different parties. It was a very partisan, sectarian spirit within Judaism. And there wasn't really, I suppose, that real heart cry, which is, what does God want? Not just, well, what does that rabbi teach? What does that scribe teach? When Jeff and I were having breakfast this morning, we were actually together enough to listen to, well, actually, it's not true. I was in the bathroom and he was in the kitchen listening to different radios. But when I came out from the bathroom, we'd listened to an article, a journalistic article, about the church's teaching on a particular topic. And there was just so much confusion. And we thought, how do people who are not Christians really know what the Bible teaches and what God teaches? Because there's this confusion. And then fortunately we listened to a wonderful piece which was about the parents of the young lad, Jimmy, whose funeral's happening, who was killed. And you listen to this Christian love that was going to forgive and not be bitter against the killers of their 16-year-old son. And that they wanted his funeral to be just a celebration of his life. And no bitterness. And you thought, what a difference. Here, out of the mouths of ordinary believers, comes this true expression of Christianity, which is forgiveness and not being bitter and looking for change. And you thought, thank goodness for that, because there's so much confusion. It's not that I want people to be dogmatic on every subject, because we don't know the answers to everything. But on those things we need the answers to, the scripture will guide us, and in this generation as well. But in this day, there was so much confusion, and Jesus starts to say to them, he didn't come to demolish or destroy the law and the prophets, but to complete them. In other words, he showed what righteous living was. He was without sin. He was righteous in the way that he lived. And in that sense, he truly fulfilled the law and the prophets, dying sacrificially for us so that we might be forgiven and start our lives again. But he fulfilled them by the way that he lived. His righteous living. He showed us what was pleasing to God. That is how we know what righteousness is. And here he's teaching his disciples to seek for a deeper inward life with God that expresses itself in practical action. He wants that connection, a deeper inner life that expresses itself in practical, righteous living, not just in religious duty, but in righteous living. And the whole of these, this passage, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, or connected together, Jesus is teaching to his disciples. And today, as we meet for worship around the Lord's table, with this literally and symbolically here in our midst, we're focusing in and looking on, in this little passage, Jesus is teaching about our relationship with fellow believers with whom we come to worship. Now, of course, it doesn't just relate to this congregation, although it does, but it relates to our wider relationship with Christian people throughout all the streams and groupings and parts of the world. Our relationship together, says Jesus, is important as we come to this time of worship. So I read in the message, if you enter your place of worship, verses 23 and 24, and about to make an offering, you suddenly remember a grudge a friend has against you, abandon your offering, leave immediately, go to the friend and make things right. Then and only then, come back and work things out with God. Or it says in the Good News, if you're about to offer your gift to God at the altar, and there you remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar, go at once and make peace with your brother, and then come back and offer your gift to God. So has anybody got anything they need to sort out with anyone here? Okay, I'll see you afterwards, shall I? That's okay. Anybody else got anything? Anybody else suddenly remembered something they should have sorted out? Okay, we carry on. Have you? Why are you looking guilty, George? Have you got anything to sort out? You tried to sort it out this morning. Right, okay. Well, come on then, because then you can get on with worship and enjoy it. Never be a student at Spurgeon's. Oh, what's the matter?
This is the bride for having me
here. Oh, what's that?
Oh, it's only £16.
So it's not your offering? £16? Oh, that's really nice. Oh, what's that for? What's that for? What, you want me to put it in an offering at the altar?
Global Day of Prayer.
The Global Day of Prayer, yeah.
This is for you.
Oh, right. That's nice. Oh. That's right.
I remembered.
Oh, you remember? Oh, thank you. What, you owe this to me?
I do, yes.
Oh, thanks, George. What did you say?
Nothing.
She's troubled, did she say? So if you're about to offer your gift to God at the altar and there you remember your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. Have a nice treat with that. We'll go and share it, George. Go at once and make peace with your brother or sister and then come back and offer your gift to God. You think, isn't that terrible? Now, it's a bit of a cheat because I said she'd already, I have to tell you, she'd already given it to Jeff because she couldn't get to me. And I said, oh, could you, I'd be awful to you and could you just, it illustrates my point. Could you? And she went, oh. But she had already done that. But, you know, if you suddenly remember, oh, gosh, I borrowed that or I should have done that or I promised that and I didn't do that. That's important. It's a small illustration. Because if I was very godly, you see, I wouldn't even have reminded her. I would have just let her keep it, wouldn't I? That's right, June, isn't it? But you see, if you suddenly remember something. Now, Jesus is obviously speaking to disciples from a Jewish background. Here he is up this mountain. Since he assumes knowledge of the altar and the sacrificial system of Judaism, he knows they know about it. So he's using an illustration to people who have a Jewish background. But he's expressing a wider principle. He's expressing his own heart in this matter, in the matter of daily living and relationships and how people are connected through to worship by their ordinary everyday lives. You see, we do not worship without considering what is going on in the rest of our lives. We don't worship in a vacuum. We come together to worship, and the rest of our lives play a major part in that. Of course, the whole of our lives are worship, and so they must connect up. I suppose the people who we often think of as hypocrites, or when we're being hypocrites ourselves, is when our lives and our worship together doesn't connect. That's when we know, well, we feel awkward, don't we? Because we think, yeah, my life isn't really matching up. And there is a problem then. And we feel that. Now, we may try and push it down and say, oh, that wasn't my fault. But it comes back, doesn't it? And it does in my experience. And if Jeff and I ever have a disagreement before on a Sunday morning, I say, I can't go and lead this service. We can't do this. We need to kiss and make up. But you can't, can you? Can you come to worship? It's tricky, isn't it? Now you're all laughing. How do you think I got this cold? Talking too much. I don't know that I did. But that's a good one. So you have to, the rest of our lives have to match up, don't they? They have to match up. This passage in Matthew 5 through to the end of chapter 7 is a collection of all of Jesus' teaching. He didn't preach this sermon all in one go. He preached this sermon dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of times, different bits of it, and unpacked it. And this is the concentrated version. You know what you get when you have a concentrated soup and you rip the top off a cup of soup, not like Mum used to make, and you put hot water in. The concentrate spreads out, and this is a concentrated version of Jesus' teaching. And the passage is completed in verse 29 of chapter 7 when Matthew says, Jesus didn't teach like the scribes, he had authority. And what he meant by that was that he had moral authority, spiritual authority, and integrity, because his life matched up to what he taught. He was different. And we will have integrity in our lives if what we say matches up with our practices. Here, Jesus challenges not just the disciples of old, but our attitude. As we go to worship, what are our relationships with other people? Non-Christians, but particularly Christians as well. We are to do everything within our power to put things right between ourselves and other members of our community of faith. Even if perhaps if for a time they won't sort it out, we're to do everything we can. We cannot say, I'll wait for them to do something. We have to do it first, whatever is within our power. This example that Jesus gives is to do with temple worship. And the Galileans would have understood it. They had this Old Testament background. They knew that the prophets, I hope, Isaiah and Amos and Micah and Jeremiah and the psalmist said that purity of life and actions is important or our worship is displeasing to God. God will not hear us if there isn't purity in our life and cleanliness in our actions. This is one of Colleen's mother's favourite sayings, isn't it, Colleen? If I go with a clean hands and a pure heart, then God will accept my worship. She keeps telling me, so I'm hearing. On solemn occasions, ordinary people were able to take a sacrifice into the courts of the priests in the temple and ask the priests to sacrifice it for them. But Jesus said, if you're going to do that and you've bought your sacrifice, you've taken a lot of trouble, you want the priest to offer a sacrifice, we don't have to do this anymore because of Jesus, but they did, then as you go and you suddenly realize, well then, leave your sacrifice there and go and sort the thing out that you need to with your brother or sister. If you've caused offense, isn't it easy to cause offense? It actually means something a bit stronger. You can almost cause offense by the way you blow your nose sometimes with people. You shouldn't blow your nose like they shouldn't. Cause offense means if you've tripped somebody up. That's how it's used in the New Testament. If they've fallen into a hole because you've put something in their way. And if you have offended somebody in some way and you remember that you've done that, then go and apologize, ask forgiveness, whatever. Put it right. And then you can come back with a clear conscience and carry on with worshipping God. And the danger is often, of course, sometimes when we've done that, people keep digging it up. I don't know why people dig up and try to resuscitate things. They seem to have an obsession with it. But if it's dealt with and finished, then it's dealt with. So this is what we are to follow as far as we can. It's very practical, isn't it? This is a lesson for us from Jesus. It's a New Testament lesson. If, as we worship, we remember something we've done that it's wrong, it probably isn't just our remembrance. It's probably God just tapping our remembrance and reminding us of something. It's a little prompt from the Holy Spirit, and it will keep coming again until we do something about it. And we cannot make our offering to God. We don't offer pigeons and cows and goats, thank goodness, because Jesus died once. But we offer ourselves when we come, don't we? We go back to the cross of Jesus and we give ourselves as an offering. But we cannot really give ourselves to God afresh until we put things right. This isn't one of us that will have to do this. We'll all have to do this at some point. This is the way that we are to live, says Jesus. And that's true worship. That makes your worship acceptable to God. Just imagine what would happen if we didn't do this. That's one of the things you'll be thinking about in your groups, is what would happen if we didn't follow this practice? Or you'd have, you know, all sorts of bitterness and grudges and resentments and hard done by stories. They would build up, wouldn't they? So we have to follow this. It's just part of keeping our house clean, as it were, the temple pure. So Jesus says to them, you need a greater righteousness. The way you live needs to be different to surpass what these Jewish people are doing at the moment. Whatever it is, if it's something we've said or forgotten to do, whatever, we need to sort it. Michael Green says, among the children of the kingdom, acceptable worship involves repairing relationships. And it will always be that, improving and developing and repairing relationships as soon as possible. Sometimes it can't happen immediately. It has to be a phone call or a letter or something in the first instance. But as soon as we can. And the verses in Matthew 5, if we were to go further on, go on to show that trouble can escalate. Because the next thing Jesus talks about is where actually grudges and difficulties and broken relationships end up in the law courts. So he's talking here about settling disputes as quickly as we can. So Jesus teaches us as his disciples to be different from the merely religious. As we come to offer ourselves to God in worship, we don't sacrifice animals, but we sing, we offer up our lives in spirit and truth, and our relationships with one another need to be in good repair. The word that I end on is, if the nets are torn, we will not catch fish. And the nets for fishing are our relationships. And we need to keep those relationships and repair them. That's what fishermen do all the time. They repair the nets. If you want the Greek for it, George, katatismos, Ephesians 4:12. Repairing the nets, putting dislocated joints back in place. That's what we're to do, because if we're going to fish, the nets need to always be in good repair. And so communion is such a special meal, because we're just here together and we're checking that our relationship with God is right through Jesus Christ and with one another. We eat knowing that we are forgiven sinners. We're going to just reflect very quietly, just for the moment. And after a quiet reflection, I'm just going to welcome in a new member and pray for them, and then we're going to just continue in the flow. But let's just reflect quietly on our own lives. And I'd like, if there's anything in our own lives that we need to sort out, or a promise to God to make that there's something we need to do, then let's take that seriously. If there's anything that we need to put right, then let's say to God, we'll do that. We've got to be practical, haven't we? We will do that. Let's just reflect quietly.